Item 13, educational session on fiduciary duties presented by fiduciary counsel.
You've made it to the exciting part of the day's agenda, finally.
And you're packing them in. You've never seen it so busy in here.
Thank God you promised lunch. Good afternoon, Harvey Lederman, Reed Smith. We do this every year. That's why it's called annual. And hopefully, we'll keep it interactive. There's changed it up a little bit this year because I want to focus on two things that we'll get into. And then I've got a couple of hypotheticals, which I'm going to lay on you if we have some time. But, you know, actually observing, and I'll come back to it, observing this morning's session, it was quite fascinating because there was a lot of talk, both by Tim, in terms of the process by which we carry out whatever we're doing, decision making, especially in the investment arena. And you heard from both the managers who presented that they have a lot of focus on internal process. And honestly, process is the key to good fiduciary behavior. It really is. It's not the ultimate, you know, just like the managers, they may turn out to be right on point and make money for us. The markets may go in ways that they don't know, but the process is really the most important part of carrying out their business plan and carrying out our business plan as fiduciaries. I want to talk about that a little bit, but you'll see. I think last year, and I'm not remembering, maybe Karen remembers, maybe you remember, because it must have been fascinating when we talked about it. But I think last year I gave you some examples of where fiduciary boards get into trouble, what they get sued for. So you had some real concrete examples of, you know, why do people sue a board of fiduciaries for breach of fiduciary duty? And the real answer is that it keeps coming up time and again in the reported cases, is that allegedly they didn't follow a good process. It's not that they are guarantors of the outcome of whatever their decision making is, picking the right assumed rate of return, projecting the markets, applying the law correctly on benefits. None of that gets fiduciaries into trouble. What gets fiduciaries into trouble is not following a prudent, deliberative process. And that's when questions arise. So we'll talk a little bit about process. I want to go back to let's start with the fundamental building blocks and go from there. You're all fiduciaries. The fiduciary, same root word is fidelity. That's why people name their dogs Fido. It's the same concept. It's the idea of loyalty, trust. These concepts derived in the common law, they then literally got written into the California Constitution, which is quite unusual, actually, that the state constitution tells you what your responsibilities are as fiduciaries. Then they got written into our governing law, the CERL, the County Employees Retirement Law, otherwise known as the 37 Act. And then you see in the materials that I've gathered for you, they're in your, all these principles show up again and again in your policies. So if you think of the construct of what governs how you're supposed to approach the process of being a good fiduciary, it really comes from a body of law that goes back thousands of years and is now devolved through the Constitution, through the state law, and into your own policies. And there's some very simple concepts. Boy, they sure include a lot of considerations. The primary loyalty rule, I want to come back to that, is to what does it really mean to be loyal? But the idea is that when you walk in here, your loyalty, your duty, obligation is to the members of the system. That's it. It's not to the county. It's not to the other plan sponsors. It's not to your employer. It's not to Sackers. It's not to Gabe personally. It's not to taxpayers. Repeat, it's not to taxpayers. It's to assure the timely payment of benefits to members and to only incur reasonable expenses of administration in doing that. Jerry.
And there's no difference between retirees and actives that are in the system. Those are both beneficiaries.
Exactly. And that's why you get paid the big bucks, because that's a really, really tough. I want to talk about that a little bit. That's part of the duty of loyalty, is that your loyalty is owed not just to the members, the active members or retirees, but to all members now and in the future. Part of that is the exclusive benefit rule, that the assets of the system are not here for your personal gain. They're not here for somebody else's personal gain. They're not administered for the benefit of the plan sponsor. They're administered solely for paying the benefits and reasonable expenses. These first two are really where much of our attention is spent on dealing with conflicts of interest, because anything that detracts from your being loyal to the membership and using the assets of the system solely to assure the payment of benefits is a conflict of interest one way or another. Some of those are punishable by law. Some of those are simply tell you when you have to recuse yourself from participating if you have a personal financial interest in decisions. So those first two rules are really the rules that tell us our singleness of purpose. You cannot serve two masters. Your masters are the members of the system. So in the materials that you've got, I included the system's code of fiduciary conduct and ethics. And on page 3 of that document, it's page 8 in my little handwritten page numbers at the bottom, there's a nice little quotable phrase there. It says, "Each member of SACERA's board shall strive to avoid activities which may impair the ability to exercise independent judgment in the discharge of official duties." And you need to, quote, "avoid giving rise to a reasonable conclusion that he or she can be improperly influenced in the performance of his or her public duty." That's really what these fiduciary duties go to. The idea that you're acting independently on behalf of the members and exercising your judgment, and any other considerations that put a thumb on the scale of that independent judgment that you exercise are really outside the bounds of what a good fiduciary does. The other thing here that we want to talk about is the prudence standard. And this is what I was alluding to before when Tim was here and the other managers were there. Tim was describing to you this morning a prudent process. How does investment staff go about doing what they're doing in terms of investigating investment opportunities, selecting managers, monitoring? He's laid out for you what is a prudent purpose, a prudent process. And interestingly, as I say, the two managers who appeared before you also each laid out for you what they consider to be a prudent process and how they go about investing your assets. So the theme through all of this comes from the prudence standard. You're held to a higher standard. You have a duty to act under the circumstances then prevailing. That means with what you can know now and reasonably project. This means you're not a guarantor of the future. You're not a guarantor that the portfolio is going to produce a targeted assumed rate of return. But what you do is you have to act in making these decisions under the current circumstances that a prudent person would, who's serving in a like capacity as you are as trustees of a public pension fund and familiar with these matters. That's a phrase we'll come back to, because that means that you're held to a standard of knowledge and expertise. There are states whose constitutions and their charters for their pension funds do not include the italicized words that I indicated in there, that this is directly quoted from the Constitution and from the CERL. And our statutes, our Constitution includes familiar with these matters. That's a trust phrase that carries hundreds of years of meaning with it in that simple phrase. And I say, some states don't have that. This state holds you to that higher standard of somebody who doesn't just have a good heart. One justice once said, it's not enough to have a good heart and an empty head to be a good fiduciary. You can't just have a good heart. You have to have knowledge and expertise, and if you don't have that, you have to go out and get it. The other two fundamental fiduciary duties are overlooked a lot of times, but very important. California has adopted, and not all states have in this regard, but California has adopted the modern portfolio theory, the idea of diversifying a portfolio, so that although you're given broad discretion in terms of investing the assets of the system, you are under a constraint to diversify the portfolio unless it's under certain circumstances, it's clearly not prudent to do so. So that's why we spend all this time talking about diversification of the portfolio, different buckets, risk diversification, risk and return balance, return diversification, sector diversification. This board does not generally engage in discussions about divesting from certain segments of the economy, for example. Other boards are more politicized. Other boards are under divestment regimes, for example, not to invest in companies that do business in the Sudan and Iran, not to do business with retailers of assault weapons. Now, these come up all the time in other contexts, and a number of systems have rather robust policies dealing with that. I raise that because what happens is that when you start divesting portions of your portfolio from certain segments of the investable market, you're constraining your diversification of the portfolio. And generally when I'm working with those funds, I have to keep bringing them back to the idea that it's one thing to have a single pothole in the street, the street being your portfolio. You can put one pothole or two potholes and drive around them, but when you put four, five, six potholes in a row, it makes navigating that diverse portfolio a whole lot more difficult. We don't engage in that kind of discussion here. Tim goes, but That's an example of where the fiduciary responsibility to diversify the portfolio can come into play.
RV, have you got any good models that come quickly to mind on an example of not being prudent to diversify?
This comes up in the context frequently under ERISA plans, especially employee stock ownership plans, where they invest in a number of things, or they make a menu of investments available to the ESOP, for example, and they also hold company stock. And there are times when holding company stock is, especially making it available in a 401k, for example, is considered to be a diversification of the portfolio. And there are times when the company's stock tanks, and there are decisions that trustees have to make as to whether to continue to overweight or weight on company stock, whether under those circumstances, if you're watching a falling knife, that you do no longer include that, or you lighten the weighting of that in your portfolio. That would be an example of when it may not be prudent to diversify into a particular sector.
Company specific.
Yeah.
Anything that would be public plan character. I'm asking because it's never.
It doesn't generally come up because, as we say here all the time, and most plans do, we are long-term investors. We're going to stay the course. So near-term circumstances seldom will knock us off our asset allocation target. So I don't see that generally coming up. I'm trying to recall. That was put in the state constitution about 20 years ago, and I can't think of any example that's come up in the last 20 years where someone has actually made a finding that it's not prudent to diversify in a particular sector under certain circumstances. Jerry?
I was at a conference in which CalPERS new CEO was there, and she was talking about ESG and going into ESG. Does that apply to this group?
Well, I actually think the discussion of environmental, social, and governance influences and how they impact your portfolio, to me, goes back to the prudence standard. I'll give you an example. At the state level, at CalSTRS, for example, we have a demonstration every month at the board meeting from teachers and others who are promoting fossil-free America. And the point being that ExxonMobil and other, Chevron and others are sitting on reserves that will not be economical and economically exploited in the future, and therefore most likely because of the impact on climate change that those assets will have and the development of alternative energy sources, that their balance sheets will suffer as a consequence of that, and therefore the ESG consideration is believed to impact the value, the shareholder value of that company. Okay, so it's not that we're considering the ESG as something as a goal in of itself to help stave off climate change. It's that without being sensitive to climate change, you're ignoring an economic consequence on many firms that should be taken into account as you exercise prudence in determining what to invest in and what not to invest in. So the whole ESG conversation has morphed from the perception that people had before that it was like do good and divorced from the economics of your investments, to now there is a more clearly established relationship and nexus between environmental and social and corporate governance issues that have a direct relationship to the economic well-being of the companies you're investing in.
So you've got more experience than most of us with other public fund investments. The one that I wonder about is gun control,
right?
And whether or not other public agencies are divesting from gun control, and how does that apply to this rule if they are? Do you know?
Generally, they're doing it at the state level primarily. New York, the New York controller, who single-handedly runs this New York State pension fund. It just decided to do that. Other systems, CalPERS and CalSTRS in the UC system, are looking at it and studying the impact of it. But essentially what it means is, and that's why I took it out of the diversification conversation, put it into prudence, essentially the argument for it is that particularly the big retailers, whose stock is held in the big indices, the S&P 500, for example, that you take a retailer like Walmart, that there will be boycotts of Walmart, there already are, by consumers of these businesses that sell, whether it's Dick's Sporting Goods or Walmart or others, and they are themselves changing their policies on gun sales, on assault weapon sales, in response to the economic consequences of them not doing that. So it's part of the it's part of looking at the economics of investing or holding public company stocks primarily. And so far, I think, you know, even when you take a CalPERS or a CalSTRS, the dollar value of the holdings, passive holdings, through index funds, for example, of these stocks, relative to the assets of the system is de minimis, as they say. Okay. And I think we would find, if we looked at our portfolio, if Tim were to look at our portfolio both on the passive public market side and even on the private side, that if you were to try to identify holdings in suspect industries or sectors, that in each instance they'd be pretty small. Fossil fuels might not be. Mm-hmm. Fossil fuels and the products produced by fossil fuels probably represents, you know, if you look at it, it could be upwards half of our portfolio. Who knows?
You're in some of
the. And so looking at the consequences. But it really is part of the conversation that we have about what are prudent considerations to focus on when you're making investment decisions and when you're asking your managers to make investment decisions. And the final thing is, you have to follow the plan documents. You have to keep in mind that the only way this system works as a defined benefit plan in the public sector is because of our exemption from taxation by the Internal Revenue Service. The IRS says, we're going to let you be exempt from tax on your investment gains, and we're going to let your members be exempt or deduct their contributions into your pension fund if you adhere to your plan documents. So one of the things we constantly will come back to is one of your fundamental fiduciary responsibilities is you have to have a robust set of documents. Our plan documents are the state constitution and the 37 Act and our policies. And that's what we need to constantly focus on as fiduciaries. I'm going to go back to, I said I would talk a little bit about what it means to be loyal. Those of you who sit on this board get here through different means. Some of you are elected, some are appointed by the Board of Supervisors, some are supervisors. Some are get here by election by active members, safety, general. Some get here by election as by retiree groups. When you get here, you do not represent those people. This is a hard thing to say. I know. You go back to your office and they call you, right? And Jerry goes home and retirees call, or David, you know. People are calling you. Members are calling you. They look to you as though you are their representative on this board. The supervisors may, from time to time, talk to their appointees. It's really hard to take those hats off and come in here and have the singleness of purpose and say, I want to do what's best for the members of the system. But that's what you have to do. You just have to have that sense in mind. You're not here to serve the interests of those who put you on the board. And because that would, in essence, be incompatible. Remember I read you that little thing off of page 3 of your fiduciary conduct and ethics. Anything that colors your ability to exercise independent judgment on behalf of the members is really a conflict of interest. So you're going to constantly be parking those conflicts of interest aside. One of the other things, and I can't remember if this has come up. Karen, tell me if it has. Some systems, members believe that if there's a difficult vote coming up, they can just abstain. And that's okay. Do we have many abstentions, Todd, in your regime?
Yeah, we have.
Not too many. But I see this a lot. I see this on very politicized boards where somebody wants to duck an issue, doesn't want to be seen as being anti-labor, or doesn't want to vote on the assumed rate of return, something like that. They'll abstain. That's really not consistent with your fiduciary responsibilities, because the law says your fiduciaries, you're supposed to be trustees who manage the plan. The Constitution is in the active verb sense. The board shall do X. The board shall do Y. And really what that means is that when you abstain, two things happen. You deprive the members of your vote. That's why we have 9 voting people on the board. But you also upset the balance. This thing, if you think about it, this is really carefully crafted balance. You got 4 elected members and alternates. You got 4 appointed and the trustee. And that's done by design, and that's supposed to be a balance. It was designed that way because it was believed to serve the members to have that kind of balance. So when somebody abstains and takes themselves out of that balance or is otherwise absent, they really upset the apple cart of the carefully crafted balance of the retirement board. And so I urge you, the only time you really want to abstain is if you have a personal interest in something or you don't believe that you can be fair and independent. Otherwise, you should be participating in voting.
Harvey, if you meet those 2 qualifications, you should be recusing yourself, should you not?
That's what I mean.
Abstention.
Right.
Yourself from the conversation altogether? Deliberation?
Yeah. And depending on what it is you want to, well, you could, without recusing yourself, for example, there could be a vote on a disability, for example. A disability application comes before you. And you say, you know what? I don't have a conflict of interest that I have to recuse myself for on this, but I know this person and I've seen them and we've had a few beers together and I don't feel that I can be impartial in making this determination. So and you say that publicly and say, so I'm going to withdraw. I'm going to abstain from voting on this. It's not a recusal. It has the same effect, but it's not something you would be required to recuse yourself for, but you're abstaining because you feel you can't exercise independent judgment. Okay?
With this board, I don't think would be a detriment because each of us have an alternate that can vote for us. So when we feel we're in conflict, like you just explained, and we recuse ourselves, then our alternate steps in and votes.
You could absent yourself from and be considered absent from the meeting, and therefore then the alternate would vote. Ed, so we've talked about the impartiality. The other point I want to make about impartiality of this is that you know that there are some decisions that impact members differently. And we talk about this all the time. It's ironically, we talk about it mostly in the investment arena in terms of short-term gains, short-term interests, and long-term investment interests. But you have the same kind of thing at play with some decisions that we make, some actuarial decisions that we make, amortization decisions, the assumed rate of return, where contribution rates are going to go, will we smooth in contributions? And the impact there, the impartiality requirement there is this. You have to have the interests of all members of the system in mind and try to balance those interests. So we get a situation where you think, well, if we can keep contributions down for a while, that really helps the membership. Well, it helps some members maybe because it helps them in their paychecks, the current active members, but it might create risk of funding in the future that will impact current retirees and future retirees. And so as you make these considerations, you want to, and again, it comes back to a diverse board. One of the things you can bring to the board is those different perspectives that you have. Well, if we make a short-term decision here to phase in contributions, is that going to underfund the system in the long run, where then we have to collect higher contributions in the future from members to pay the unfunded liability that we didn't pay in the past?
Did PERS just do that?
Well, sure they did.
Just confirming.
But that's the thing. You have to wrestle with these as a fiduciary, the balance, and it's not easy. There are a lot of decisions that have to be made that are going to impact your membership differently. So you're given broad discretion in this. Fortunately, you're not held to a firm rule. You're allowed to exercise your judgment, but in exercising that judgment, you want to avoid sacrificing the long-term goals and long-term interests of members for short-term gains. And vice versa. I mean, it's very difficult to get all these actuarial decisions straight, and that's why we true them up every couple of years. We revisit it so that you get closer and closer to the equity of funding the system in a constantly going forward basis and not having the volatility where you suddenly have to collect more contributions. This idea of impartiality and members that I'm talking about shows up in this U.S. Supreme Court case from a number of years ago. It's an NLRB case, and so I've highlighted the language. I don't want to spend much time on it. But you see, does this have a pointer? It does. Yeah, right there. An employee benefit fund trustee is a fiduciary whose duty to the trust beneficiaries must overcome any loyalty to the interest of the party that appointed him. There is a distinction between the process by which a person is appointed and the manner in which he performs that office after he's been appointed. So that's my point, and the Supreme Court said it better than I did. Let's talk a little bit about what it means in this fiduciary responsibility to be prudent. As I said, you have a heightened prudence standard. You're held to the level of a person familiar with these matters. That means that if you don't have the expertise on a particular subject, you go out and get it. We had a good example of that today. You got a CIO. You're talking about risk parity, investment allocation. That's something that's in the wheelhouse of most of this board? No. What do you do to go out and get it? Well, you get your CIO. What does he do? You go out and get Verus to assist. What do? Well, they actually bring in the managers to talk to you so you can make an educated decision. We go through a process. They go through a process. This is what I was talking about, a process. They go through a prudent process of developing knowledge and expertise for you so that you can make an educated decision under the circumstances now prevailing. Circumstances change. Circumstances in the commodities market certainly have changed over the last 5 years. But we can only make a decision in the snapshot that we have today. Nobody is a soothsayer. And then your obligation of prudence is that once you make a decision, boy, Jerry was right on. What did you say to Ed this morning after the vote?
Which?
I want you to watch these guys.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I want you to watch these guys. I want you to keep your eye on this portfolio. That's exactly right. Perfect. Mm-hmm. You don't set and forget. You're going to come back and revisit it. We have quarterly reports. We have semi-annual reports. We have annual reports. You make Tim explain, how's the portfolio doing? You got Varis comes in and says, here's what we're doing. You want them to constantly monitor and report back to you, how's our decision? Okay, so that's part of the duty of prudence.
You know, Harvey, I've been sitting on this board for 15 years now. I'm in my 15th year. And believe it or not, I have really kind of done a 180 on the final average salary situations. And what brought that to light, I mean, when I first came on this board, I thought we have the Cadillac. When people retire, they're going to be so happy because they're going to get all this extra money that's not just going to be their base salary. And I thought they deserve it. That's part of what we do. And then what I didn't realize and learned through what we did as a board and what our staff did in bringing it to light for us is, for me, is when people jack their final average salary by 15% and 20%, I don't mind somebody that moves it up 5% or so, or even maybe even 10% if it's a line staff person that doesn't get a big retirement. But when I see that going into thousands of dollars, and then realizing that's an unfunded liability that we're responsible for 5 years from now, 10 years from now, and that's a drain on the system. That was such a light bulb experience for me, which was 180 degrees from where I was when I came into this board. And this board has not heard, I mean, I've said this before to this board. And so when we make decisions, especially monetary decisions, it really needs education and knowledge and presentation to us about what happens down the road
consequences.
With that decision.
Yeah, that's good.
You know, and that.
And you know, you get better at this. That's one thing that doesn't appear in any of the scholarship over the discharge of fiduciaries and trustees roles. You get better at this the more you do it. It's like anything else. Yeah, you really get better at this, because I think this is a very arcane business. Have you ever tried to talk about what you do at these board meetings at a cocktail party to somebody? They're right into the fish dip, right? You know, it's like, nah, I mean, this stuff is glazed territory, you know. But we have to drill into it, and you don't. You know, you come on this board, and you don't have the peripheral vision that you get after a few years, and it's hard to get. And even when an actuary comes in or a lawyer comes in and talks to you about the intricacies of, you know, vested rights and the California rule or something like that, you just glaze. You know, it's too much to digest. You go to the investment conferences and you try to digest everything they're telling you, and by 10:30, you're toast. I mean, you're just filled with. So you have to keep at it and keep at it and keep coming back and keep coming back. And so, has it been 15 years, Jerry? Wow. But.
Seems longer.
Shut up.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But that's it. You start getting more, but that I call it peripheral vision. That's what you you have to go out and get other people on the board who have experience with it, or your experts or your staff who are also experts that you hire for this purpose to give you that vision so that you can see that you can see the consequences of your actions. And that is the exercise of prudence. Once again, I've quoted a more recent case. This has to do, this was the General Motors stock drop case, actually, ERISA stock drop case. And they were sued because the trustees, State Street Bank was the trustee of the General Motors. You remember General Motors. The General Motors ESOP, and they held on to the stock in the ESOP as it was running down and down and down. And they got sued for breach of fiduciary duty. And the question, and it came up to the appellate court, the federal appellate court, and the question was, did they breach their fiduciary duty by making the decision to hold General Motors stock and ride it all the way down into the tank? And they were exonerated by the Court of Appeals for the reasons that are stated here. They took into consideration the risk of loss, the opportunity for gain, considered the portfolio's diversification, liquidity, and projected return relative to their funding objections. At the time they engaged in the challenged transactions, that's the phrase under the circumstances then prevailing, they employed the appropriate methods. We must focus on whether the fiduciary engaged in a reasoned decision-making process consistent with that of a prudent person acting in a like capacity. I tell you again, the stock tanked and the employee's ESOP suffered 40-50% losses. The fiduciaries are not a guarantor of the outcome of the markets, but they engaged in a reasoned decision-making process, and therefore they were held not to have breached their fiduciary duty to the employees. That's all we can assure. So we're going to keep talking about process and process on the investment side, the actuarial side, all decisions you make. The determination to, you know, this came up again this morning. This was a great laboratory today, now that I think about it. We had a disability application. We had findings of fact to support a decision. Those findings are what courts will look at to determine whether or not you engaged in a reasoned decision-making process. That's the map, the roadmap, to demonstrate that the process you went through was reasoned, was fair, afforded the applicant due process, and the decision was based on reason. There's another example, you did it today, of prudent decision-making with the system's interests at heart. So, any questions at this point? Anything on anybody's mind we want to talk about? If we had a couple of minutes, I was going to hit you with a couple of hypothetical scenarios. What do you think? How are we doing time-wise? Gail? Todd?
I'm good on time. I don't know about the board, though.
Let's try...
Let's do one.
Two.
You want to do one?
Two.
Your best one.
Best one. I'll give you the toughest one.
Okay.
No, I'm not going to give you that one. You can look at that one. Let's just do the first one here. Okay. You're looking at this first time. We have an appointed board member, not in this system, some other system. And by the way, if you look through the scenarios, each one of these scenarios are very, very close to true stories from other systems, not this system. Haven't masked a whole lot. They actually, these are situations that I personally have been in and had to deal with boards. Here's one. Appointed board member, that's an appointee, sick and tired of sitting through all these disability applications, right, on appeals. So she makes a motion to adopt the following policies. All disability applications and appeals will go to a committee. The committee will be made up of three members. either elected or retiree, because, you know, they're closest with the employee situation, so they have the best knowledge. That's the reason. The second thing is the committee's actions will be placed on the board's consent calendar, and it will take a two-thirds vote to pull their decision off the consent calendar. Okay? In any event, the committee's decisions will be binding on the board unless two-thirds of the board votes to overrule them. So the three elected or retiree members will form a committee. They'll make all the decisions essentially on disability applications, and it'll take a supermajority, two-thirds vote of the board, to do anything different. Okay? Dr. McDonald, do you got any problem with any of this? Well, you're going to get to sit on the disability committee. What do you think? What do you think? Any problem?
It deprives the board, the entire board, of discussing the issue or the particular matter, and that's the charge of the board. So that kind of sidesteps it.
You do have the authority to delegate, right? And Rusty doesn't like, Rusty's shaking his head. You don't think we have you can delegate?
No, I think that's part of the role of being on the board, is that you have to sit to these meetings no matter what.
That's a bummer. Whatever, who voted for him?
He said a lot about no matter what.
Well, okay, let's talk about it. Wouldn't this be prudent delegation to delegate this to a group of people who are closer to the employment situation, have a greater understanding of...
No, because this is just a delegation out of convenience. It's not one with a real purpose except for to get it out of the person's... It's taken up that individual's...
Well, she's not going to say that out loud in a public meeting. You know. You don't think this is a proper delegation? Let's talk to an appointed member, huh? What do you think, John?
I don't think it's a proper delegation.
No? Why not?
Well, I'd start out saying when you have a focus of employees being the ones making a decision like that, very understandably, employees are going to be more, I think, sympathetic to disability claims.
I don't know. They might be harder on the disability claim.
And we've seen signs of both, by the way. I think... My period on this board where we've had both elected and appointed take roles that I wouldn't have expected. But in general, the balance that we have through the process of how the nine of us got here is lost when you go to a select group that doesn't represent any of that balance. So I'd start out with that. But I think one of the basic roles of the board is to make a decision on disability claims.
Well, would it make any difference if we changed it? The three members, you know, just got voted. They could be appointed, elected, the treasurer. Would that be okay? Would that give you the balance you want?
It'd be a better balance, I think. But having said that, I'd still go with the role that I think that's a design responsibility of the board as a whole.
Okay. Any other comments on that? Jerry, have you had your chocolate yet?
I was just going to add, I think as part of our fiduciary duty to the fund, it's also to the members, and that they have a right to have a hearing by the full board on something so critical as this. And because the determination goes to future funding as well as our fiduciary duty to the fund itself, and the integrity of it, you need to have each member voting. It's sort of like your example of saying, well, half of you want to abstain, okay.
Yeah.
So to me, it's just one of the integral roles we have.
An abdication of the responsibility you have as a board member. One of the responsibilities is that if you don't have enough knowledge about a particular subject, you're obligated to go get it, not to simply delegate it to someone else.
Rusty?
Well, my concern too here is the trust factor. Again, you don't want to lose trust either in the members or the public for that matter in making a prudent decision that affects a person's livelihood. So I would be careful, even given the appearance that there's some bias on fairness. So I personally would put it back on the whole board.
That, you know, that's a very interesting point here, too, and it doesn't appear in fiduciary lore, if you will, but if you step back and look at who we are and what we do, this is a public body. It's supposed to be making decisions in public, and this deprives the public, and maybe the member, the applicant, of transparency, and, you know, that's a cue into Karen's talk in a little bit. Of the transparency of how the decisions are being made. If a small committee, and it's only three, so it's not a Brown Act committee, it's less than a majority, right? So maybe it's a standing committee. You'll deal with that. But the transparency is gone there. The public has a right to know and see when these decisions are made. So these are all excellent points.
Also, on the appeals comment, I wouldn't think that you would have an appeal going back to the body that made the original decision. You know, it makes sense to have the appeal go to a different authority.
Oh, okay. Yeah, appeal is kind of a loaded word because it's in this case it would be an appeal from a staff recommendation or a staff determination to the board. That's what I mean, not an appeal from the board to someone else. So, yeah, that gets really confused in the disability aspect. So I think we should do a wrap at this point. If there are any other questions, I try.
So did that come out scenario number one with the board that was with the motion that was made? What happened with that motion?
Well, what actually happened is that
they appointed
a three-person committee, and their actions do get placed on the consent calendar, but only if the committee is unanimous, and then the two-thirds stuff is gone. Anybody can, just like any other agenda item, somebody can pull it off the consent calendar, and it still takes a majority vote of the board to adopt the committee. The committee makes recommendations, but it goes on consent calendar if it's unanimous among the committee. Actually, if it's unanimous among the committee's attorney, a disability attorney, and the committee's and the doctor. So it has to have five people say grant or recommend grant or not grant, and then it goes on the consent calendar. But the two-thirds requirement is.
So are you counsel to this plan?
I am.
I'm sorry. They missed your lecture.
Happens, Jerry. Sometimes there are plans that just don't follow my advice. Can you imagine that?
How many examples from Contra Costa are you using elsewhere?
Oh, I don't want to go into that.
And not attributing it to
with
us.
That, I thank you. And each time I do this annually, I try to bring another layer of the onion and a different aspect of it. So maybe we'll do ESG, fiduciary responsibilities around ESG next year. But thank you for letting me come in and talk about all this stuff with you. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Harvey.
Thank you.
Well,
it doesn't. You had your chocolate. Huh?